Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. The panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofino. You are the only case set for oral submission, although we have a very full afternoon considering cases submitted on the briefs. So since you're here, and since I assume you have no objection, we're going to start a little bit early so we can finish all our work this afternoon. So both sides are ready. Would you call the case, please?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tom Stouch, and I represent MBR and Associates and Brian Ramon in this case. The parties, I believe, have done an excellent job in briefing the issues for the court, so I'd like to highlight just a few key issues for you today. Before I begin, though, I have to fall on the sword a bit. We discovered a typo in our reply brief, and there are three instances in which we refer to the testimony of Mr. Lyle, and we cited that to volume four, Roman numeral four of the record, and we flipped it. It should be six, Roman numeral six, and I apologize for that transposition and any confusion that may have caused. With that said, this is a property damage case involving a property that was already damaged. It is undisputed that my client, MBR and Associates, work did not begin until April 2003. In December 2001, there was a significant water leak at this property, and that resulted in extensive damage and mold growth. Additional leaks were discovered in the home, as well as a roof leak. The house was in such a state of disrepair that the insurance adjuster called out actually advised Mr. Lyle to move out of the home. He didn't do that initially, but he did do it in August 2002, almost a year before the events that we're talking about here. So I think it's important to note that this home was uninhabitable at the time of the injury that we're talking about here in this case. There was no sheetrock. There was no flooring. It had all been ripped out. No cabinets. It was unlivable. Those, I believe, are significant facts because that is the backdrop against which we have to analyze the court's award of damages in this case. Actual damages in terms of repair costs or fair market value, especially with regard to mental anguish for this house that the plaintiff, the appellee, was not living in and was in such a state of disrepair. The second point that I would like to make for the court is that the basic damage model pursued at trial was flawed. In a typical property damage case like this, the plaintiff can recover the cost of repair plus the loss of use or diminution in value if the damage is a permanent damage. Under the facts of this case, and as it was presented at trial on the record, neither are recoverable for Mr. Lyle. Mr. Lyle's trial counsel put on evidence of a cost of repair of $132,000. But Mr. Lyle's own expert on direct examination testified that those costs of repairs would exceed the fair market value of the house. Now, that as a matter of law violates the economic waste rule. So the damage to the property is considered permanent. And if the damage to the property is permanent, cost of repairs, loss of use are not available as a matter of law. It can only go under the fair market value.
I have a procedural question.
Yes, ma'am.
I noticed that there are 215 findings of fact and multiple conclusions of law, and I'm not seeing which ones you're challenging on appeal. So is your issue number one, are you saying that as a matter of law, the wrong value is applied, or is it a challenge to the evidence, or I'm not seeing which findings of fact or which conclusions of law or what standard of review you're wanting us to apply?
Your Honor, I don't think that I have the basis to challenge the finding of fact on the cost of repairs of $132,000. What I'm challenging is then the award that's based on that, because there is also evidence in the record that the fair market value, that those cost of repairs exceed the fair market value. So I don't believe that the ultimate legal conclusion or the award that's based on that is valid under Texas law. In the appellee's brief, the opposing counsel attempts to recharacterize the expert testimony that destroyed their own cause of action for damages, and talked about how the fact that he said, well, the property can be repaired. He did say it could be repaired, but there's no evidence in the record of what that repair cost would be from that expert. I think the goal of that question was, well, can it be sort of repaired in a lesser manner to get it to a rentable condition? But they didn't go on and ask what those damages are. So the only evidence this court has before it is $132,000, and their expert saying that's more than the fair market value of the home. So then they realize on appeal, they realize this problem. So they refer to the testimony of Mr. Lyle himself, that the value, in his opinion, of his home was $160,000 to $170,000, and therefore greater than that $132,000 cost of repair. The problem with that theory is that, and while an owner can testify to that, that testimony must be clear and unambiguous based on facts in the record, which there were none to support here, and that it must relate to the fair market value immediately before and after the event. That's where that testimony falls apart. Mr. Lyle's testimony, if the court will look at the record, he was asked a question by his lawyer that, what do you believe the house would be worth in good condition? Well, it's undisputed this house was not in good condition. He wasn't living there. It was uninhabitable. So it was a hypothetical question of the value if it were repaired. But to recover under that theory, he would have to have rendered an opinion on what it was worth immediately before this injury that my client allegedly caused, and then immediately after, and that evidence is not in the record. So while it may seem like a harsh result, in this case, on this record, cost of repair and loss of use are not available, nor is the diminution in value, because there's no evidence of value immediately before and immediately after the injury. The third point I'd like to raise is that mental anguish damages should not be recovered on these facts. In this case, the mental anguish and the briefing from Appalee indicates that this is an award arising from the destruction of a house, but it was the destruction of a house that was already destroyed. In his brief, the Appalee contends that he uttered these magic words of mental anguish at trial. None of that testimony is supported by any objectively verifiable fact, document, or testimony, much less expert testimony. And it's that standard that we challenge here, because it's based solely on self-serving, uncontrovertible testimony of the plaintiff himself, that he cried, that he lost weight, that he lost sleep. And I think the Texas Supreme Court has struggled with this, and it has repeatedly tried to characterize the type of cases that mental anguish damages are awarded in. And they've specifically found that in property damage cases, under the Tyler versus Likes opinion, that generally property damage cases are not that type of case. In this instance, there's no physical injury to the plaintiff himself. There was no special relationship between the plaintiff and the defendants. And this is not the type of shocking or disturbing fact pattern that would normally award or justify the award of mental anguish, like there might be in a race discrimination case or a sexual assault case, when we can all understand that the event itself is going to be shocking and disturbing and generally lead to mental anguish. We just don't believe that the plaintiff uttering these magic words, I cried, I lost weight, I lost sleep, can be the standard for recovery of mental anguish damages as a matter of public policy, or the danger becomes that every plaintiff in every case, every tort case, is going to utter that magic script. For example, I think I've probably suffered those same symptoms, maybe on a lesser basis, just getting ready for this appeal. But nobody can prove otherwise. It's just my own testimony. So even if there is some past mental anguish that was supportable under this record, we then find that $250,000, $250,000, is just, we believe, an abuse of discretion under these facts when the cost of repairs themselves are less than half that amount, and the house was already uninhabitable and not being used by the appellee. As for the future component, now the past was $250,000, future, the award was $50,000. As for the future mental anguish recovery, there was no evidence presented at trial as to the expected duration and severity of the future mental anguish. All there was a question that said, well, we've talked about your past mental anguish, what about your mental anguish in the future? And the plaintiff testified that it was reasonable to infer that he would continue to have mental anguish. That doesn't cut it under the Fifth Club versus Ramirez case that we've cited in the brief. We believe the award is unsupported as a matter of law and should be reversed.
Okay, I have a question on that point, too, because you haven't, the trial court made a specific finding of fact concerning the mental anguish being suffered, and that finding of fact hasn't been challenged on appeal. So my question is, are you saying that as a matter of law in this case, I mean, I'm just not clear if you're wanting us to do a legal sufficiency of the fact or a factual sufficiency of the fact, or if you're saying that just as a matter of law, mental anguish damages aren't recoverable for this type of property damage.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think almost all three. And the factual insufficiency with regard to future particularly is there's just no evidence presented as to the future future mental anguish. It's got the law is that you've got to put on testimony the expectation of duration and severity. It's just not there. So that would be a factual challenge. The legal sufficiency, I believe, is sort of tied to the as a matter of law on the past mental anguish of $250,000 under this standard. We believe Tyler versus Like says on this type of case, a property damage case, you don't get mental anguish damages. And we believe there's a good reason for that, if for no other reason, a public policy matter, that it just opens this door that everybody's going to walk through.
Is there a place in your brief where you challenge the findings of fact? Because if findings of fact aren't specifically challenged, they're binding on that.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that we've challenged the findings of fact with regard to the $250,000 based on there's no evidence to support that other than the plaintiff's own testimony himself. And we believe that under that Tyler versus Likes line of cases, that's not good enough. So it's a legal sufficiency challenge, if you will. And we just believe that it's not only under Tyler versus Likes, that type of testimony is not sufficient for the reasons that the court discusses there, because it's too easy for any plaintiff to testify to that, but also as a matter of law, the public policy argument is the secondary basis for that challenge. The fourth point that I'd like to make is that the claims against Brian Ramone individually were barred by limitations. Mr. Lyle waited 3.5 years to file suit against Mr. Ramone, almost 2 years after the statute of limitations expired on any DTPA or negligence cause of action. There was no confusion about when the injury occurred. It occurred in April 2003. Mr. Lyle contends that the error there is harmless because there's also a fraud finding, but that's not the standard of review. Each finding needs to stand on their own 2 feet. Even the fraud finding, we believe, is suspect because Mr. Ramone never had any conversations with Mr. Lyle whatsoever. So we think there's a problem with causation there, and we've briefed that for you. The next argument made is that Mr. Ramone is the alter ego of MBR and Associates, and we believe that this was just put forth to try to get around the limitations problem that they had, and we don't believe that there was sufficient evidence presented at trial of that alter ego finding. And as this court has noted, the use of alter ego is appropriate only in exceptional cases. They sort of cobble together several alter ego slash agency arguments here of the three sort of defendants they're going after, even though only two of them are really real, Ryan Ramon and NBR and Associates. They talk about this NBR-GFR, which all that is a trade name of the company itself. So they try to connect Brian Ramon to his company as an alter ego, NBR and Associates, by making that bridge to the trade name. Well, a person and his trade name cannot be alter egos of each other. If I have a lemonade stand as Tom's Lemonade, I am not the alter ego of Tom's Lemonade. It's just me. So they've got to follow the law in terms of a finding of alter ego, and we don't believe they've done that here. NBR GFR is merely the trade name of the company, NBR and Associates, not the alter ego of Brian Ramon. NBR GFR's profits were included on the company's tax returns, not on Ramon's tax returns. NBR and Associates filed liens for the work that was done under NBR GFR. NBR and Associates and NBR GFR shared offices and phones and supplies and equipment. NBR and Associates paid for all NBR GFR employees. Those are all things you would expect based on a trade name. That's how business operates. So an alter ego plaintiff has a substantial burden because the alter ego attempts to circumvent the law shielding persons from corporate debts. Here, the evidence is that Ramon is just not the alter ego of his company. And I see that my time has expired.
May it please the court, I'm Leighton Durham on behalf of Mr. Lyle. If I could, I'd like to start by short-circuiting a few of the arguments. First, by clarifying one point. Mr. Lyle's home had been through quite a bit of damage, but it also been through quite a bit of repair. At the time that NBR and Associates showed up, most of the repair is done. And if you look at page 32 of volume 5 of the reporter's record, the remediation was complete. The only thing that needed to be finished was sheetrock and cabinets, but that couldn't be done until after the foundation was done. So we're at a point where Mr. Lyle is about to move back into his house, and his house is destroyed by what's going on with NBR. The other point that I think really short-circuits a lot of this is the fraud finding, because I think it narrows the issues the court has to address. The trial court found that Mr. Ramon himself committed fraud, and that wasn't challenged, not until in the reply brief, and which is a little too late, but it's also irrelevant. They argue that Mr. Ramon never spoke to Mr. Lyle and that the people who did were not his agents. But that's not exactly true. The testimony from Mr. Creed was that Mr. Ramon instructed Mr. Creed to tell potential clients they were going to have a master plumber and an engineer overseeing these projects. And that wasn't true. So that wasn't Mr. Creed's misrepresentation. That was Mr. Ramon's misrepresentation. And he's liable for that because he had reason to believe other people, like customers, would rely on that. That's important here, and this is why it matters. If he's liable for fraud, statute of limitations doesn't matter, because it's a 4-year limitations. It supports the same damages, and it doesn't matter whether he's also liable for negligence. All of the vicarious liability questions go away as well, because if he's directly liable, it doesn't matter if he's vicariously liable. And it has an important impact on the mental anguish, which I'll get to when we talk about mental anguish damages. The only thing challenged with respect to fraud was the proximate cause issue, which defendants argue was they merely created a condition that allowed this to happen, but it's a little bit myopic in this situation. The representations were that this company had certain qualifications, and those were lies. They did not have those qualifications, and the damages resulted from a lack of the qualifications. They broke the foundation because they didn't have an engineer, and they filled up this man's pipe with cement because they didn't have a plumber there to perform the tests that were required. This is no different than the Greenstein-Logan case that we cited in our brief, where the representation was with regard to an accountant who then went to work for somebody. That accountant lacked the qualifications he needed and caused millions of dollars in damages. The same proximate cause analysis was rejected by the Waco court in that case. So if we get through this fraud, that really eliminates a number of the issues that the court has to consider. Turning now to the cost of repairs, their first issue. The key here is to remember that this was the defendant's burden of proof. There are two proper measures of damage, cost of repair and diminution in value. The plaintiffs were required to prove one. We weren't required to disprove the other as part of our burden, just prove one. And the cases that we've cited to you establish that if a defendant is dissatisfied with the plaintiff's choice, it bears the burden to prove that the alternative damages were less. They didn't even try that in this case. They didn't cite to you an expert that they brought forward that testified to the diminution value. Instead, they cited the testimony of Mr. Nichols, who wasn't an appraiser. He was an engineer. He testified extensively about all the different damages that had occurred. He did not testify as to what the property value was or even testify as to what the cost of repair would be. In fact, the defendant's objective when he was about to testify as to what the cost of repair was going to be. So there's really no foundation for him to even say in the record why he thought that these repairs would exceed the value of the home. We don't know what he thought the value of the home was or what he thought the cost of repair was. The only person who testified about the value of the home was Mr. Lyles, who at least lived in the neighborhood. And the defense has argued, or the appellants have argued, that he really didn't know what the value was and he didn't have any foundation for his opinion. But that argument cuts both ways. If Mr. Lyle didn't have a foundation for his opinion, Mr. Nichols didn't have a foundation either, and what we're left with is a situation where there's no evidence at all in the record from which a trial court would be required to find that the diminution in value was the lesser measure of damages. And that's not my problem, because we met our burden of proof. We proved our cost of repair, and it was defendant's burden to prove otherwise. And if that were really what they were trying to do at trial, they would have had experts there. This is something that's been manufactured post-trial as an effort to find a way to dislodge this cost of repair damages, which were appropriate. The next issue is the mental anguish issue. And first of all, mental anguish damages are not precluded in property damage cases. There are two basic areas under the Likes case where mental anguish damages are appropriate. Number one is where you're going to involve a physical injury. And if you have significant physical injuries, then of course even negligence causes of action will support mental anguish damages. The other area that the Likes court recognized was when damages result from intentional and malicious conduct, like we have here. We have fraud findings. And in that situation, it is the defendant who is guilty or has committed these fraud who bears the burden and the difficulty in either predicting or verifying that the damages were true. It's always difficult to verify mental anguish damages, but if you've committed fraud, that's going to be your problem, at least as far as the Likes court is concerned. That's why in DTPA cases, we have a statutory right for mental anguish damages when we have knowing and intentional violations. And in this case, there's ample evidence of mental anguish. This was not just brick and mortar to Mr. Lyles. This was his home. He's lived in it since 1968, and this was his means of providing for his family. He testified that that was his responsibility. He is from a generation where he believed as the man of the house, that was what he needed to be doing. And he was devastated when he felt like he couldn't do that. The testimony was that when he showed up and saw cement pouring out of his toilets and out of his bathtub and them trying to clean it up, after a while they left him there by himself to clean it up and then never came back. He was there walking around the house crying, trying to figure out how he was going to take care of his family. And it made him physically ill. He had stomach problems, trouble sleeping, and high blood pressure. It has destroyed his home and his finances. And this is not something that just sort of happened for a week or something along those lines. The testimony was it continued through trial, April 2003 through 2007. This has caused significant disruption in his daily life because it has destroyed this man's life, or at least his, you know, finances and the like. And so you have a four-year constant worry over finances. That's significant disruption that would support a $250,000 award. Plus, because it went all the way through trial, I mean, for the 4 years, we can infer that, in fact, it was going to go somewhat longer. And that would support the $50,000 for future. There are two cases I think you could look at to support this. The first one is the Latham case that we cited as a DTPA case for past mental anguishes where the plaintiff was sick, nervous, mad, physically ill and vomited, and that was sufficient to support the past mental anguish. I think if you look at the Fifth Club v. Ramirez case that they cited to you, it helps us with the future mental anguish case, because in that one, although that involved a physical injury, they found that because the mental anguish had continued for 2 years up through trial, there was reason to infer, and they affirmed an award of future mental anguish damages. We have a very similar situation. 4 years of mental anguish, we can infer that $50,000 worth of mental anguish continued past the date of trial. Turning to vicarious liability issues, I don't think you need to get to this point because of the fraud finding. But if you do, there's a way to simplify this as well. The only real question is who's responsible for MBR GFR. That's who signed the contract. It's either Mr. Ramon or it's MBR and Associates, one of the two. But the truth is, it's not going to matter all that much because the evidence is that Mr. Ramon and MBR and Associates are alter egos. If that's true, then Mr. Ramon is responsible for MBR GFR, even if the appellants are correct that MBR GFR is just the trade name of MBR and Associates. Resolution in this case, I think, turns on the Schluter versus Carey case that's from this court from 2003. And this is what the court said. If the shareholders themselves disregard the separation of the corporate enterprise, the law will also disregard it so far as necessary to protect individual and corporate creditors. And they listed the factors, which are the degree of property is kept separate, percent ownership and control, use of personal purposes, and financial strength. And in this case, they're so intertwined, Mr. Ramon can't even tell you which is which. Not just the two entities, but himself as well. He is a sole shareholder. He is the president and CEO, so he has full ownership and full control. But on top of that, MBR and Associates, right up to the eve of trial, owned the home that he was living in with his family. This is one entity. He's running all of his business, all of his personal stuff through one entity. They are clearly the alter ego. And there's also an injury here. Mr. Ramon wants to put all the liability into MBR and Associates, but let's not forget that MBR and Associates was the one who told him they had insurance to cover issues just like this, and that was another lie. It wasn't true. What they had was a forged insurance certificate. And Mr. Lyle said he never testified, that he never saw the certificate, but he also testified that the representatives told him they had insurance, and he relied on that. So we have a situation with an unbonded judgment right now against a company that doesn't have the insurance they said they had. There's clearly injury resulting from this alter ego. The next issue is whether MBR GFR was the trade name of MBR and Associates or was actually just an unincorporated business of Mr. Ramon. And I think this turns very clearly on the ownership history. It cannot be that MBR GFR is a trade name of MBR and Associates because they have totally different ownership. MBR and Associates started in 1995 and by 1998 was 100% owned by Mr. Ramon. MBR GFR started in 98, started off as a 75-25% share with Ramon and Mr. Hughes. In 2000-2001, Mr. Hughes was out of the picture. 15% was owned by Sean Lawson and 25% by Mr. Marvin Compton. Then Mr. Lawson came out of the case, or came out of ownership, and by the time this happened, Mr. Ramon owned 75% and Mr. Compton owned 25%. So at the time these representations were made, they have completely different ownership histories. So it can't be a trade name if it's owned by different people. And that's probably why in the second volume of the clerk's record at page 350, MBR and Associates actually argued in a summary judgment that in fact MBR GFR was not the DBA of MBR and Associates. There's only one other option, and that's that MBR GFR was the business of Mr. Ramon personally. And if that's the case, then he's liable for those, for the injuries that occurred from his, as part of the liabilities of his own incorporated business. The last issue is whether Mr. Creed was actually a representative of MBR GFR or some rogue employee as indicated. And that's just not true because Mr. Creed himself testified that he was trained by Mr. Ramon, and even Mr. Ramon, who initially denied that Mr. Creed was part of the company, when confronted with his deposition, admitted that by March 2003, he was representing MBR GFR. There's plenty of evidence to support the trial court's finding there. On the limits, excuse me.
Do you remember Justice Walker's question about the procedural posture of this case?
Not sure which one.
Addressing the findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Yes.
address her question, please?
The law, as I understand it, and I've actually had situations where I've had to face that in the past, and that's if there's no challenge to the finding of fact, then you're bound by it if there's evidence in the record to support it. There's plenty of evidence in the record to support each one of these findings of fact. But if there's not challenged, then you're bound by it. And I can happy to provide you with that case if you'd look later. Sure. I've seen, but you never know. The limitations issue, again, not a problem if we have fraud, but also it's not a problem if you affirm the alter ego theory, which establishes that if you sue the company, the alter ego is on the hook as well. And we've identified the misidentification argument as well, and I'm almost out of time and don't want to get to a situation where I can't fully explain myself. So if you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer those. Thank you so much.
Is there a rebuttal?
May I please support? With regard to the issue of damages, where counsel referred to the burden of proof, that's what we're referring to, too. And they did not meet their burden of proof. They actually proved neither of those possible elements of damages. Cost of repair, their own testimony on direct examination from their expert negates cost of repair because it's the economic waste rule, and they put on no evidence of diminution in value immediately before and after the injury. The fraud issue, they claim that there's a finding of fraud against Ramon because he owns this company, but if we dive a little deeper into that, we have briefed in our brief that there's a problem with causation there. And we cite, the case we rely on is IHS versus Mason. And in that case, IHS released a mental patient early, and that mental patient was then in a car wreck. And the court said that all the IHS did was furnish a condition or create a condition that allowed the accident to happen. So the plaintiff's argument was, no, you set the ball in motion, and but for you setting that ball in motion, I never would have been hit by this car. And the court said, well, no, that you can't split that hair because there's still, but for that negligent activity or the negligence in the car wreck itself, the injury never happens. Well, that case is directly analogous here in that even if you believe that there was deception or fraud in securing the agreement, securing the contract, without the negligent acts, and we don't dispute that our employees were negligent in the process, in the performance of the mudjacking job, but even if you assume there's fraud to secure the contract, had the employees performed the job correctly, as they've done thousands of times over the last 20 years, this case doesn't exist. There's no damages. So that's the negligence. That's the issue. And we don't believe that that's proximate or producing cause under the law. I don't believe they pled an intervening cause. That the subsequent negligence of our own.
Well, that if facts supported that Mr. Ramon instructed Mr. Cleary to go out and make misrepresentations, he did so following instructions, but for, and then there was an intervening cause of, well, you wouldn't have been damaged except for the negligence of the employees. There was an intervening cause between the acts of Mr. Creed and what ultimately caused the damage, because you had pleaded through that. I'm not really following your analogy of, well, we're going to ignore what Mr. Creed did, because if they hadn't been negligent, it wouldn't have caused any damage.
Your Honor, I don't know that I can speak to that issue because, frankly, and I apologize, I don't know whether that defense was pled, but I do believe that the way the case was tried, that the issue of that lack of cause was brought out in the trial, and the record supports it. But in your question, if I may, you sort of reiterated what counsel said, which is this assumption that Ramon told Creed to lie,
and
that was a direct quote from counsel, and I will challenge the court because it is not in this record. And counsel tried during the trial to get Mr. Creed to say it, and he wouldn't say it. In fact, the record is that Mr. Creed had one meeting for 10 to 15 minutes with Mr. Ramon about going to work for him. They talked about his qualifications, and ultimately Mr. Ramon decided not to hire him. There is no evidence in this record that Mr. Ramon told Creed or Bryant to lie or misrepresent any fact. And it ignores the history of this company that they've had thousands of successful jobs over the years. And I think, if I may, that sort of segues into the very problem with this alter ego concept. And that is that under the law, the alter ego, the examples that the SSP Partners case gives are when the corporate structure itself has been abused to perpetrate a fraud, evade existing obligation, achieve or perpetrate a monopoly, circumvent a statute, protect a crime, or justify a wrong. In this case, even if you were to assume that there was some fraud committed on the front end, it was committed by individuals who were allegedly working in their job that also had performed admirably on other jobs. And so that's not the corporation committing a fraud. That may be an agent of the corporation committing a fraud, but that doesn't justify alter ego. The cases say that you've got to have evidence that it was set up to commit a fraud, to set up to scam people. And there's no evidence of that in this case. And I see the mic.
In finding of fact number 174, the trial court specifically found that MBR and Associates, Inc. and MBR GFR were used by Ramon as a sham to perpetrate a fraud on the public, and Lyle in particular, as well as a means to evade existing legal obligations for the purpose of perpetrating actual fraud. And he used them as such, primarily for his direct personal benefit, and he used the sham to perpetrate a fraud and avoid existing legal obligations on Lyle. During discovery in this lawsuit, by contending that MBR and Associates was the only proper defendant and proper party, then alleging otherwise when it suited Ramon's purposes, and hiding the true identity of the party who did business with Lyle and committed the conduct destroying his sewer system and house. So this is the problem that I'm having. We have all these findings of fact like this, and no one has challenged it.
I understand, Your Honor, and I guess I could go back to that famous quote that he who wins the war writes the history. Obviously, that finding of fact was written by the trial counsel, opposing trial counsel, after the trial, either at the request of the trial court or on his own. But the problem is, and what we challenge here, is that that finding is not supported by evidence in the trial.
But where is that in your brief? Where in your brief are you challenging finding of fact number 174 and setting forth what the evidence supporting it is and what the evidence against it is?
Your Honor, I don't know that we have specifically called it out that way. And if
that's what I'm thinking has to happen. I'm thinking that in order for a finding not to be binding on us, there has to be a specific point of error or issue presented challenging that finding and saying whether there's no evidence to support it or factually insufficient evidence, but there's got to be some type of a challenge weighing the evidence of that finding for or against. Otherwise, this is what we have. It's the same as a jury finding after a jury verdict. You know, we're not the finder of fact. We can't go back in and go behind it and say, well, we don't think this and we don't think that. We've got to work from the roadmap of the findings of fact, and that's my real concern in this appeal.
I appreciate the question, and I understand your concern, and I suppose my response to that, the best response, is just the sheer volume of those findings of fact and conclusions of law as espoused by the trial counsel. Were we to challenge every one of those specific fact findings, there's no way we could have done that in the size of a brief. So I think what we attempted to do is shoot at the heart of the issue and challenge those findings, including any findings of fact upon which the ultimate issue rests. Because
but
if the...
I can't tell from the brief, is it making a legal sufficiency challenge or a factual sufficiency challenge, or is it just saying, as a matter of law, this cannot be. This doesn't exist as a matter of law. And that's...
And I apologize if we did not do that properly or clearly. I think all three of those are in our brief in different, depending on what the issue is. On some, we have challenged that there's no evidence of this in the record. For example, the finding that Ramon told Creed or Bryant to lie or misrepresent, there's absolutely zero evidence of that in the record. So we believe that we've challenged it in that way. Now, whether we set out a specific point of error number 32 or 252, no, we didn't do that, Your Honor.
And I don't think it's necessary to do point by point. I've seen it done with party group and say, you know, the fraud findings of fact are finding, you know, 1, 2, 4, 8, 9, 10. We're challenging those. You know, here's the evidence, here's it. But there's not any, I haven't found any specific challenges. And if I'm wrong, please correct me, but I haven't found any specific challenges to any of the findings of fact.
I don't think you're wrong, Your Honor. I think what our intent was and what our goal was to do what you were saying, is grouping these core issues of the fraud finding, the DTPA and the negligence finding on the statute, the alter ego findings, and challenge them issue by issue that way, and perhaps on a subset level we should have included or called out specific findings. But again, with a 50-page limit, you know, briefing limit, I don't know how that's physically.
I don't want to do it.
Right. I understand.
I think that it's not my job.
I understand, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming here today to argue. It's been very helpful. The briefing is helpful. And, you know, it's not an easy drive, so we appreciate the courtesy to the court. And